Today, a matter of perspective, the DFA Daily for the 3rd of May 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World and Latest Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. I'm recording this on Sunday, and with less news coming in today, I wanted to just delve slightly more deeply into a few articles which really gives us a rather important matter of perspective. I'm going to start with Noelle Rubini, the Professor of Economics at New York University's Stern School of Business. He was featured in The Guardian, spelling out 10 reasons why a greater depression for the 2020s is inevitable. After the 2007-09 financial crisis, the imbalances and risks pervading the global economy were exacerbated by policy mistakes. So rather than addressing the structural problems that the financial collapse and ensuing recession revealed, governments mostly kicked the can down the road, creating major downside risks that made another crisis inevitable. And now that it has arrived, the risks are growing even more acute. Unfortunately, even if the greater recession leads to a lackluster U-shaped recovery this year, an L-shaped greater depression will follow later in the decade, owing to 10 ominous and risky trends. The first trend concerns deficits and their corollary risks, debt and deficits. The policy response to the COVID-19 crisis entails a massive increase in fiscal deficits on the order of 10% of GDP or more, at a time when public debt levels in many countries were already high, if not unsustainable. Worse, the loss of income for many households and firms means that private sector debt levels will become unsustainable too, potentially leading to mass defaults and bankruptcies. Together with soaring levels of public debt, this all but ensures a more anemic recovery than the one that followed the Great Recession a decade ago. A second factor is the demographic time bomb. In advanced economies, the COVID-19 crisis shows that much more public spending must be allocated to health systems, and that universal health care and other relevant public goods are necessities, not luxuries. Yet, because most developed countries have aging societies, funding such outlays in the future will make the implicit debt from today's unfunded health care and social security systems even larger. A third risk is the growing risk of deflation. In addition to causing a deep recession, the crisis is also creating a massive slack in goods, unused machines and capacity, and labour markets, mass unemployment, as well as driving a price collapse in commodities such as oil and industrial metals. That makes debt deflation likely, increasing the risk of insolvency. A fourth related factor will be currency debasement. As central banks try to fight deflation and head off the risk of surging interest rates following from the massive debt build-up, monetary policies will become even more unconventional and far-reaching. In the short run, governments will need to fund monetized fiscal deficits to avoid depression and deflation. Yet over time, the permanent negative supply shocks from accelerated deglobalization and renewed protectionism will make stagflation all but inevitable. A fifth issue is the broader digital disruption of the economy. With millions of people losing their jobs or working and earning less, the income and wealth gaps of the 21st century economy will widen further. To guard against future supply chain shocks, companies and advanced economies will reshore production from low-cost regions to higher-cost domestic markets. But rather than helping workers at home, this trend will accelerate the pace of automation, putting downward pressure on wages and further fanning the flames of populism, nationalism, and xenophobia. This points to the sixth major factor, deglobalization. The pandemic is accelerating trends towards balkanization and fragmentation that were already well underway. The US and China will decouple faster, and most countries will respond by adopting still more protectionist policies to shield domestic firms and workers from global disruptions. The post-pandemic world will be marked by tighter restrictions of the movement of goods, services, capital, labour, technology, data, and information. This is already happening in the pharmaceutical, medical equipment, and food sectors, where governments are imposing export restrictions and other protectionist measures in response to the crisis. The backlash against democracy will reinforce this trend. Populist leaders often benefit from economic weakness, mass unemployment, and rising inequality. Under conditions of heightened economic insecurity, there will be a stronger impulse to scapegoat foreigners for the crisis. Blue-collar workers and broad cohorts of the middle class will become more susceptible to populist rhetoric, particularly proposals to restrict migration and trade. This points to an eighth factor, the geostrategic standoff between the US and China. With the Trump administration making every effort to blame China for the pandemic, Chinese President Xi Jinping's regime will double down on its claim that the US is conspiring to prevent China's peaceful rise. The Sino-American decoupling in trade, technology, investment, data, and monetary arrangements will intensify. Worse, this diplomatic breakup will set the stage for a new Cold War between the US and its rivals, not just China, but also Russia, Iran, and North Korea. With the US presidential election approaching, there is every reason to expect an upsurge in clandestine cyber warfare, potentially leading even to conventional military clashes. And because technology is the key weapon in the fight for control of the industries of the future, and in combating pandemics, the US private tech sector will become increasingly integrated into the national security industrial complex. A final risk that cannot be ignored is environmental disruption, which, as the COVID-19 crisis has shown, can wreak far more economic havoc than a financial crisis. Recurring epidemics, HIV since the 1980s, SARS in the 2003, H1N1 in 2009, MERS in 2011, Ebola in 2014-16, are, like climate change, essentially man-made disasters born of poor health and sanitary standards, the abuse of natural systems, and the growing interconnectivity of a globalized world. Pandemics and the many morbid symptoms of climate change will become more frequent, severe, and costly in the years ahead. These 10 risks, already looming large before COVID-19 struck, now threaten to fuel a perfect storm that sweeps the entire global economy into a decade of despair. By the 2030s, technology and more competent political leadership may be able to reduce, resolve, or minimize many of these problems, giving rise to a more inclusive, cooperative, and stable international order. But any happy ending assumes that we find a way to survive the coming Greater Depression. And then the ABA came out with this. More than 500,000 Australians have one less thing to worry about today, with banks providing a six-month loan deferral on an estimated $6.8 billion of business, mortgage and other loan repayments due to the impact of COVID-19. Data released by the Australian Banking Association shows that so far, more than 320,000 homeowners have been approved for a loan deferral on their mortgage repayments. An additional 170,000 business owners have also received a deferral on their business loan repayments, and nearly 37,000 other loan repayments, such as personal loans and credit cards, have also been deferred. In addition to make money available to business as quickly as possible, more than $45 billion has been provided in new loans and a further $6 billion through increases in existing loans and credit facilities. ABA CEO Anna Bligh said the decision by banks to defer payments will no doubt take some of the pressure off Australians who are doing it tough at the moment. Bank call centres have been and continue to be inundated with people needing help. Many of these people have never had to ask for assistance before in their lives and may never again. I would strongly urge anyone who needs support to contact their bank. Since the start of the pandemic in Australia, banks have provided more than $45 billion in new lending to Australian businesses, including nearly $8.5 billion to more than 23,000 small businesses. Banks have also been getting on with the job of injecting funds into the Australian economy. Since the start of the pandemic, the Australian banks have provided more than $45 billion in new lending to Australian businesses, including nearly $8.5 billion to more than 23,000 small businesses. Supporting and helping businesses to grow is vital for the success of any economy, Ms. Bligh said. The actions of banks will help inject much-needed investment into the economy, with the deferrals, new lending and increased credit allowing people and business to spend on the things they need. Australia is in an enviable position. Our banks are the most stable and some of the strongest in the world. The strength of Australia's banks has allowed the industry to step up and play a key role in helping not only our customers, but supporting the recovery of the Australian economy through one of the most challenging periods in our lifetimes, Ms. Bligh said. And to that, I reply, yes, but all of that extra debt is one, going to put more interest back onto the banks, and two, will still need to be repaid. If unemployment comes back down quickly, that might be okay. And if firms don't collapse, that might be okay. But the concern is that the broader perspective here is that unemployment will be much higher than previously, incomes will be stagnant, and therefore people will have great difficulty in repaying that considerably larger debt than previously. So in a way, debt repayment holidays may well be postponing the inevitable. We'll see. And Stephen Long at the ABC wrote that the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed some of the downsides of the so-called just-in-time economy, a defining feature of capitalism during the past 3 to 4 decades. He says, I'm using the phrase to invoke an economy defined by a lean and at times mean philosophy and approach to everything from production to employment and a financial system enmeshed with it. The term just-in-time was popularized in the 1980s and 1990s to describe a system of production and a management philosophy that aimed to cut costs and eliminate waste by procuring and delivering everything just when it's needed or just in time. Toyota was a leading proponent of just-in-time production, its factories and supply chains engineered from the 1970s so that components arrived just as they were needed for assembly. Avoiding the costs of holding inventories and warehousing was a key part of the strategy. This required the development of sophisticated logistics to manage often global supply chains to ensure just-in-time delivery. All good until supply chains are disrupted, as they have been in the pandemic that has hit myriad businesses from tech giants such as Microsoft, Apple and Samsung, through to the makers of critical medical supplies. That's prompted a reassessment by some of the federal government's leading right-wing hawks, such as the chair of the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, Andrew Hastie, who found themselves in an unlikely alliance with the protectionist left, all advocating more resilient supply chains, insulated from the prospect of global disruption and a rebuilding of domestic manufacturing capacity for critical goods. There's less attention from those MPs to the just-in-time workforce, which the economic fallout of the virus has exposed as another vulnerability. Casualisation, labour hire, self-employment in the so-called gig economy and zero-hours contracts are all manifestations of a just-in-time workforce, where the worker becomes an economic buffer absorbing the risk of variation in demand, as with just-in-time or lean production. The trend towards a just-in-time labour force accelerated in the 1990s in response to recessions around the world in the early years of that decade. Employers who'd been stuck with fixed labour costs when demand and revenue fell responded by cutting back their ongoing workforces. A core of ongoing employees was surrounded by an expanded periphery of part-time, casual and contract labour who could be upsized and downsized as required. For business, there was an obvious cost advantage in being able to tailor work hours by the day and by the hour to meet demand. Like widgets on the assembly line, workers are sourced and delivered just in time. The just-in-time workforce also shifts power from labour to capital. People in insecure jobs are less inclined to speak out, push back or unionise. Business groups like to argue that the flexibility is a two-way street, and it is the case that some workers do enjoy the freedom that gig work or temp work offers. But there's no denying that in aggregate, it represents a massive shift of risk from capital to labour. In effect, the risk of variations in demand has been shunted on to working people, who in turn face increased financial risk as they try to navigate bills and mortgages without security of employment or income. It contributes to the rise of the just-in-time household budgets, where people live hand-to-mouth, with more than a quarter of Australian households reporting that they have less than $1,000 in cash savings. In good times, this is a risk to individuals and their families. In bad times, as the COVID-19 pandemic demonstrates, it can quickly become a systemic risk. Those people who are absorbing the risks of businesses now become, in their large numbers, a systemic risk for the overall economy, says Dick Bryan, an emeritus professor of political economy and co-author of Risking Together, How Finance is Dominating Everyday Life in Australia. Official estimates showing that nearly 800,000 Australians lost their jobs in the space of a week or so as the crisis hit were a stark illustration of how quickly the flexible workforce can become collateral damage, with their loss of earnings threatening to unravel the economy and financial system. The lack of a buffer for many businesses in the just-in-time economy has also been brought into stark relief, with so many enterprises utterly reliant on short-term cash flow, with few resources to fall back on. Although its motivations may have been humane as well as economic, the government really had little choice but to drop its opposition to increasing the dole and instead doubled it in response to the COVID-19 job shock. Likewise, its reluctant decision to subsidise wages, even though many casual workers have no access to this safety net, without that intervention and similar measures from governments around the world, there is no doubt we would have seen a catastrophic financial system meltdown. Because alongside the just-in-time workforce, we also have a just-in-time financial system. Just about every payment from mortgages to utility bills has been bundled up into financial securities and are sold and traded around the world. Securities backed by utility bills have come to be seen as a near risk-free investment, more secure, according to some, than treasury bonds. But if the steady stream of secure repayments were to dry up, those securities would plummet in value with disastrous consequences. Quite literally, if every household were to stop paying its utility bills, the financial system would collapse, says Mike Rafferty of RMIT, co-author of Risking Together, and it would only take an unexpectedly high share of households to renege on payments to push the system to the brink. No surprise, then, that in the United States, banks are reportedly preparing to garnish people's economic stimulus payments from the Trump administration to pay debts. Despite this, so far the systemic risk from precarious work in a financialized world is barely featuring in the political debate. On the contrary, businesses demanding more labour market deregulation and flexibility on the other side of the crisis to build productivity and revive the economy. There's a saying in economic circles that we learn the lessons of the last crisis just in time for the next one, or too late, as the case may be. And Bloomberg opinion columnist Megan O'Sullivan wrote that the world is on the cusp of a geopolitical reset. The global pandemic could well undermine international institutions, reinforce nationalism, and spur deglobalization, but far-sighted leadership could also rekindle cooperation, glimmers of which appeared in the G20's offer of debt relief for some of the world's poorest countries. A joint plea from more than 200 former national leaders for a more coordinated pandemic response and an unprecedented multilateral pact to arrest the crash in oil markets. The remarkable effort to address the turmoil in the oil markets will be critical to oil's eventual balance, although the past 2 weeks have shown that its promised production cuts were too slow and insufficient in the face of oil demand's plunge. The challenges and opportunities the collapse in the oil market is pushing to the fore are perhaps just the first taste of COVID-19-induced geopolitical crises that world leaders and policymakers will need to grapple with in the coming months and years. As history has shown, a big change in energy markets often precipitates a big change in geopolitics. For instance, the shift from coal to oil catapulted Middle Eastern countries to strategic significance, and the recent technology-driven boom in shale oil elevated the United States to net oil exporter status, changing its outlook on the importance of oil in global affairs. We now face a disruption of such proportions that it, too, will reorder some power relationships. And she concludes, a US failure to address the more immediate challenges stemming from the oil crisis does not bode well for any larger effort to try and remake the world order. So standing back, it's clear to me that above the day-to-day interplay with regard to the virus and how to deal with it and the financial fallout, there are some bigger picture questions which need to be thought about. And those relate to the way that the economies around the world are going to develop, And I don't think that we should lose sight of the environmental agenda. And it's important we don't overlook the really critical issues that still need to be addressed around climate alteration. This is a very complex time, and I wonder whether our political leaders are up to the challenge. Regretfully, I'm not totally sure that they are. And finally, before I go, a quick reminder that on Tuesday at 8 p.m. Sydney time, I'll be running my next live stream event. You're welcome to ask me a question live in the YouTube chat, or beforehand by sending a question via the DFA blog. The links are in the comments below. We'll be updating our latest scenarios and also updating our mortgage stress data. I look forward to seeing you on the live show. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.